right, ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Schaefer and Geyer Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got an excellent show, a fantastic guest who we're gonna keep that little suspense in the air, and bring in our hosts Michael Schaefer and Michael Geyer. Michael Schaefer, how are you?
Joe, what's happening?
Well, you know, it's we're in the thick of winter, and you know, I mean, you know, we're just all trying to get through it. We had a couple snowstorms, right?
It's the hangover of the Super Bowl, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know what's great, though? There are TV commercials now for the Masters Golf Tournament.
Oh, yeah.
And when you see that and then you see the Phillies rolling into Florida, it kind of makes you realize we got seven more weeks of lousy weather, but
right,
it's right around the corner.
Yeah, no question. And the Phillies are making moves. They just signed somebody today, an infielder, an all-star infielder, which I don't know his name right now, but my wife said that he doesn't mind coming off the bench.
That's something.
But, you know, so many injuries in baseball, yeah. 162 games. We just did get, we're a monthly broadcast, and so we just did the Super Bowl. I mean, we just had the Super Bowl a couple of weeks ago. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, it was a great game. I mean, I think that Mahomes is in the Brady conversation.
He is
inevitable. It's the inevitable. He's like, when you think about Jordan, you think about Bird, Tiger. Tiger Woods had that too. Like, if, you know, he has the ball, it's inevitable.
There's something about him, right?
Yeah, it's just something.
It's a dynasty.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that, and let's bring Caitlin Files into the show. How are you, Caitlin?
I'm doing well. How are you, Joe?
Fantastic.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Our pleasure.
I fought it every step of the way, but they just over.
I know. You're not my biggest fan.
The heck I'm not. By the way, Caitlin's monthly show, The Files Law Hour, I drive, basically to North Dakota to do the show wherever.
You're so dramatic.
Up to, by the way, it's an unbelievable area.
Yes, it is. Bucks County.
At Bristol Borough, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, wow. We go to Bristol Borough a lot. Yeah, I get you free beers, so I don't know what you're complaining about.
I'm not complaining. I was just kidding. But, you know, when you talk about this, and everybody can jump on this, the greatness, you know, when you talk about Brady and you talk about Pat Mahomes and you know, like, I mean, Jordan's at a whole, you know, it's a different level, but still, you know, definitely one of the things that's important, though, and this, I'll lay this out there, in order to have a Pat Mahomes, okay, it, you know, like a Montana and Walsh, mm-hmm. okay, Brady and Belichick, you know, that great coach and that quarterback combination, it is like magic. I mean, you usually don't have one. Peyton Manning did not have one coach, and he won a couple Super Bowls.
Jordan had Pippen. I mean, they always had to have something with him.
It makes me rethink who's more valuable, the coach or the quarterback.
Well, Brady.
And you see, when Brady left Belichick, Belichick fumbled, mm-hmm. fell apart. When Andy Reid was in Philly, he had Donovan. Donovan's not Mahomes.
But he wasn't all-pro quarterback, but he wasn't quite Mahomes, mm-hmm. right?
I think it's, you know, it's, they always have something with them. And it's like, you know, and when Brady wasn't hitting on all cylinders in his early part of the career, he had the defense. And I think they always have something with them, but there is that inevitability that they have. And it's just...
Well, you just look at...
It becomes that mystique, and almost like, you know, when Montana had it too, it's like, man, he's got the ball, we're toast. Like, you know what's going to happen.
Well, you look at what happened in the one Super Bowl against Cincinnati, went right down the field. the old saying, when he's in the huddle and he looks up and sees John Candy there, right? And said he was that cool and collected on the last drive to go the distance when, you know, everybody else and, you know, 99% of the people would be scared to death. Yeah. But you mentioned Pippen and Jordan. Well, I mean, Travis Kelce,
they always have like a
go-to,
like a Batman Robin. There's like got to be something with them.
Oh, you had Rice and Montana and Young and Montana.
Yeah, football is such a team sport, though. I think you have to really. It's different than basketball. It's different than golf, especially. But it's you've got coordinators that are as responsible for individual plays as the coaches for the overall kind of game plan. And I saw something in on Reddit, and we've talked about it before, who would be the Philadelphia sports Mount Rushmore?
Oh, well,
I saw that. Mm-hmm.
Even like modern era, you know, Will Chamberlain, Mike Schmidt, Iverson, Bobby Clark. But then
I'm open to that conversation.
People are chiming in. What about does Jason Kelce get on there now? What about there's some Eagles over the years, but football is really hard to.
It's a great question. My wife and I were talking about it yesterday. She was reading that to me yesterday. Okay, let's kind of, you know, we're going to go into the law and all that.
We can talk about football the whole time. I'm fine with it.
No, not football, but the Mount Rushmore of sports here in Philadelphia.
Before you go there, I have a 6 degrees for Mrs. Kelce for me.
Go ahead.
She was my daughter's field hockey coach.
Oh, my God.
And I was on the interview committee, and she just had graduated, and she was like kind of putzing around trying to figure out what she was
doing. You voted against her, didn't you?
And I was one of the people that hired her.
Oh, great.
And so before Jason Kelce was Jason Kelce, he was come to the games and kind of sit in the back on the side. And I have a friend that works for the Eagles, and I kind of went up to him like, hey, we have a buddy together. And so this is like before he's Jason.
Right.
He was the nicest guy on the planet. Mm-hmm. And he still is. But yeah. I'm telling you, like, even before he was super, super famous. Just the most down-earth guy, and he was talking about my daughter on the field hockey, and he didn't know anything about field hockey, so I'm trying to explain to him the rules of field hockey, and he's like, what does that mean? Why did the whistle blow? And it was just, it was really, so we watched a couple games together, and it was just, it was really great.
Were you the one that gave him the pointers about, you know, how to pull his son? Before we go in, let's do this then, Mount Rushmore. There's no way you can pick just one Eagle, okay? We were actually talking about it yesterday, but... If you're going to pick top five Eagles, okay, Kate, you got anybody in mind?
Dawkins is my favorite Eagle of all time.
Okay,
so B-Dawk would be before Jason Kelce for me.
Well,
for sure.
There's no way to go wrong with B-Dawk. Mm-hmm. He ever buys a beer in this city again, whoever's in the in the vicinity is getting it.
Oh boy,
Michael Geyer.
You know, Donovan's got the statistics and doesn't have a ring, but great quarterback. Had a mixed fan emotions and feelings for him during his career, but his numbers got to put him in the top five.
But I definitely think Donovan's definitely up there. Mike?
I'm going to get some backlash, but I love Randall. Like, I thought Randall was the first, Randall Cunningham was the revolutionary quarterback.
I know, guys. Totally, I know it was before my time.
The pink sweater threw off.
You remember.
Was I alive?
All right, listen, guys. I hate that. I'm going to slam dunk everybody here, but except B-Dawk. Reggie White.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got the sack record of all time.
Yeah. But he left us.
I got a problem for guys who leave us. I feel that way about,
Charles Barkley.
He got kind of forced out, I think.
I love Charles Barkley.
Me too.
I love Charles Barkley.
He got traded.
His the greatest line of all time, but Charles Barkley. I asked for Shaq, and they gave me Charles Shackelford.
That's right. I feel that way about Scott Rolen.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit like, I'll get some flack.
Eric Lindros?
Schaefer. Kobe Bryant couldn't wait to get out of Philadelphia.
He didn't have a choice, though. He was drafted by somebody else. And you know what I love about Kobe? I mean, I love so much about Kobe, but when the Eagles won that Super Bowl, that video with him holding the baby running, that shit, right then and there, I'm like, he's Philly all through.
Yeah, that's actually when I first started to like Kobe. I never liked Kobe before that. Yeah, well, he's a Laker.
He beat us, he beat us in the championship.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me go around. B-Dawk, no question about it. B-Dawk, Reggie White. Ready, guys? Here's one you cannot deny, and it's Nick Foles. He won the MVP of the Super Bowl. How can you? I don't care if he played three
Nick
good
Foles.
Games.
Put him on.
I'm just saying. But if you look, okay, so B-Dawk, he's universal, okay? Sixers, Michael Geyer, Michael Schaefer.
Joey
Sarver.
Mm-hmm. Iverson, Barkley. Maurice Cheeks.
Supposed to go one.
I would say Iverson. I grew up with Iverson, so always Iverson for me.
I like Iverson is because he and I had a similar crossover.
You do. I could see you playing ball like Iverson.
He wasn't as quick as I was, though. I have to go with Dr. J.
Or Will Chamberlain.
But Will Chamberlain, you can't. It's very difficult to pick. The two of them.
The way Barkley. the way Barkley just kind of came, and his now, his longevity from player to media has been spectacular.
Oh, he's incredible.
He's great.
Absolutely
he's great.
Spectacular.
All right, well, here's one where we're all going to be unanimous. No question about it. Philadelphia Phillies.
Just
pick one.
Oh.
You got
well,
one.
I'll start with Mike Schmidt.
Yeah, that's what I would say, Mike Schmidt.
All right. We're unanimous. I want David Doster. He was a one-year guy.
Know that is.
Me and my nephew always joke around.
I mean, Bryce Harper's getting close to getting up there.
My wife said Bryce, but you can't pick Bryce.
Do you know what? He's getting close.
Yes.
You know what year he's in of his contract?
Seven.
It's about to start year seven of his 13 years.
Oh my God!
He's like unbelievable. I mean,
the guy is money, man.
He says he's going to play into his 40s.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about you're in the hangover of the sports, here's my take: what we shouldn't have the hangover sports. I think they should move college basketball start to January, have March Madness in May, because no one pays attention to college basketball while there's football. So if they started college basketball in January, then we'd be picking up speed and they'd watch the games now. There's nothing that happens in May. Put the March Madness in May. It would be unbelievable.
There are
May, I like that.
May
I like
Madness.
That
it would be unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about sports, very few college sports go two semesters. College basketball goes both semesters. You have to play in the spring and the fall. So if we're talking about the student athlete BS, they pretend that they care about the student athlete. You have to play both semesters. So let them start in the spring semester and just play one semester. It would be great because people would start pay attention to college. No one pays attention because by the time the Super Bowl's over, the basketball season's over.
The problem is, and why we think it's a good, we came up with this idea 10 years ago. He and I did. There are great college basketball games on in December and January. ESPN has them every night, but no one's got the time to invest in college basketball because you got NFL and college football going on. So just can it in December and January, start it now in February, and then
the doldrums.
Yeah.
Everyone's at home looking for something to do, and they're putting it on college basketball now. I agree with you. I think we should start later.
Start those little dinky,
all right, I'm going to make some calls.
I didn't even realize Marquette is like a top five team or something until yesterday.
Been number one. It's like all these great teams and these, like, you know, I remember like Duke was great and the Leitner and you had, you know, all these great players. You know, I know they only stay for one season, but there are a lot of good players.
Well, that's something interesting. I used to watch a lot of college basketball. I mean, I watched the Villanova National Championship game at my buddy Mark Persichetti's office with my best friend Joe DeLuca. And it was the first. And I got to know Ed Pinckney pretty good because he used to come to my nightclub. Mm. But he used to come in like an Izod top. I mean, the dude was like as straight as an arrow, right? He would call me and go, I guess, hey, Joe Doc, great. I'm coming over. Was such a nice guy. And but remember watching those games. What's interesting about college basketball now, and this is why you're going to – and I'm not into it nearly like I was, but I know this. Once they start one and dunning and all those things, now all of a sudden the big powerhouses can't hold on to players long enough, and now you see – teams struggling at times.
It's frustrating. Connecticut's good. I mean, those teams are good now. They have players that stay for two and three seasons.
They stay.
And it's very entertaining. Those kids are going to be good, and they're going to be very fun to watch. Those players will stick around for a while, and you'll get really good players.
Just what I do, like everyone else, March Madness comes, and I do a crash course on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of that first week, because I haven't really kept up with it. And if we started it a little later, I might.
Well,
that's my solution.
The crazier things have happened. I mean,
it's because
the ratings are way down, and it's not gonna come back. So like the ratings have to, you got to get interest, and it takes interest to build. And everybody likes college basketball. I mean, it's way better than the NBA regular season. You know, the regular season kind of drags along, but college, I mean, I like the NBA playoffs, but the college basketball season, the stands are packed, everybody's, you know, storming the court. It's a great thing.
All right, we'll make some calls.
We'll get it done.
We'll get it done.
We'll take care of it. Now Joe and I know.
We know Tim we'll Witherspoon.
Yeah. The big boxer is going to help me out in the college basketball arena.
So let's talk a little law on the docket. Then we're going to bring Caitlin Files in, talk about Files Law. What's on the docket?
We just finished two cases. Mike will talk about one. I'll talk about the other. We just finished a arbitration on Friday. So many times we have cases that will go to arbitration.
You're good. Don't worry about it. So. You actually look at it. Take it from right here. And yeah, just like that. It's perfect. And you can bend this. You're good.
Okay. Better.
Okay, perfect.
So we had an arbitration. So many times what we'll do is cases that are scheduled to go to trial, the clients will decide to go to arbitration. So it's a binding arbitration. What we'll do is we'll hire a judge, and that judge, we're waiting for the decision. So let me tell you really quick what that case was about. So we have a client that was on a medication. He had a heart condition, and he was on a medication, and one of the things that this medication caused is a lung condition that could kill him. And he was on this very, very strong drug that was for his heart. And he was supposed to get a chest x-ray. And if you've ever been to the doctor, you'll go out to the front desk and your doctor will give you a prescription for the test you were supposed to get. Over 6 years, he never got that piece of paper. He was supposed to get a yearly chest x-ray to determine if he had this lung condition. The doctor blamed the front staff. The front staff said, that's the doctor's responsibility. Lo and behold, he developed this lung disease and he died. And the doctor blamed the front staff. It was like a comedy affair. It was like a circus. They were like, oh, they were supposed to give you the form. And they was like, it was like, you know, like a junior high. Oh, they were supposed
they're
to have
his staff. It's the doctor's staff.
Yeah, correct. It was like the dog ate my
it
homework.
Was not cool.
Yeah, what?
She threw her staff onto the bus.
Like, and we had the staff come in, like, and the Lance staff Armstrong all testified. They're like, that woman's crazy. She doesn't work there anymore. And they said, that never happened. That wasn't our policy. It was the doctor's responsibility.
But even if, okay, so even if they don't go get the x-ray, when he comes back in the next year, isn't the doctor like, next wait, where's month. The x-ray? You didn't what get it done.
Even worse, what she put in the thing was getting chest x-rays. And she put in the thing, getting chest x-ray. And he wasn't getting the chest x-ray.
Oh,
which was really
God.
Bad.
And to make matters worse, or to, you know, hit you when you're down, their second defense to this was, well, even if we made a mistake and didn't tell him to get an x-ray, he died of something completely different anyway. He didn't even die from our mistake. He died from something else, so we don't have what's called, like, causation. That's their claim, is that, hey, we made a mistake, but even though we did, no big deal, he died from something altogether different. And it's just...
And the problem they had was every doctor,
yeah, it's icky.
Every doctor that treated this man while he was dying said he had this pulmonary toxicity condition. Like, doctors at Penn, we had an autopsy. The family hired a private autopsy. The pathologist said he died of that condition. It was horrible.
Oh my God.
And this woman, the widow, was just this beautiful, strong, just a terrific client. It's like one of the things that we're lucky is, like, we just get to represent some of the nicest people. And the sad thing is we don't get to see the before.
How old was the patient?
67 when he started, 65 when he started, and 71 when he died.
That's horrible.
So we'll
That's
wait.
Horrible.
So we'll wait.
We finished on Friday. The judge will take some time to give us a decision.
Wow.
And then, Michael, you want to tell us about our yeah. 2 weeks?
God, we've been really busy.
Are these the cases that you call me up about and ask what you should do? Oh, maybe not that one.
Consulting.
That was the basketball game. I'm sorry.
So we were brought in to try a case towards the end of the litigation.
One month before jury selection.
Yeah. In Delaware County, in Media, which is a challenging county, but we had a terrific judge. And it was a... obstetrics case. It was a delivery of a child that went wrong, and the doctor pulled the child's head and tore the brachial plexus, which is the series of nerves that go from the spine down into the shoulder. And it happened 8 years ago, and it's a beautiful girl, but she's got a shoulder deformity, and she can't lift her right arm over her shoulder level. She has a peculiar look to her shoulder blades. It's a real thing, and she's going to have problems, and it's going to be expensive to do things like she can't really use a keyboard. She won't be able to drive with her hand on the wheel. So it's a lot of things to look, you have to be careful worth the problems in the future. So we sued an obstetrician and medical practice and the hospital. It's an out-of-business hospital. But there's a group of attorneys, defense lawyers in the area that are just top-notch defense lawyers, and they defend these cases all the time, and that's who we went against. And we had a terrific judge. It was a long trial. It was going to be 3 or 4 weeks. And then, without getting too into specifics, on the ninth day, one of the experts went rogue and started the day at 9:30 in the morning. At 4 o'clock, he's still on the stand, and he started using the words falsified, fraudulent.
You mean their expert?
No.
Oh, no.
One of our experts.
Okay.
And it was a mistrial, meaning that we have to try the case again. Because
on the ninth day of the trial?
Yeah. And the defense wanted a mistrial. And we didn't take a position on it. So the judge told us, think about it overnight. Bring your legal research in the morning. And we didn't really want to push back too hard. But the expert was not... he apologized. And he really... kind of caused a lot of heartache and expense and energy and all that. So we're going to try the case again. But that happens sometimes. And
has it never happened to us?
Well, you see it on, it was like you see on TV.
Yeah.
You see it on TV.
That's rough.
And
like we were doing depositions on, because we were getting ready for trial. We got brought into this pretty late. We were doing a deposition. I did a deposition on Saturday night until 8:30 at night.
It was a January 3rd. Trial started.
How come you just got brought in so late?
That happens a good deal to us. Like the trial, we're trial lawyers, so another lawyer that needs help, will say, hey guys, we need help. Help us try this case. Usually, when that happens,
you get a couple months at least, right?
Or we take over from the word jump, and so this lawyer wanted to stay in the case, which was great because she's a very nice woman. But it was her. It was her expert, and
I was going to say whose expert. I got you.
And it's a lot of a case like that is a lot for just one lawyer to handle. I mean, it's just Saturday nights,
yeah.
Clients Sunday morning. The jury was picked on January 3rd, which meant we were working over Christmas and New Year. So,
oh really? When we were prepared to go for this trial, when it was going to go for 4 weeks, what was the plan?
Well, I had a long planned,
oh, yeah,
extended family vacation.
Oh, really? You were going to, where was that vacation?
Hold on.
Where was that vacation?
Hold on.
It was wonderful. We had such a great time.
That was during our show, too, wasn't
that
it?
That was when you were in Mexico.
All the
and
kids.
I was going to be on the I was going to be stuck in trial.
I would do it again if I had to.
No regrets.
It was in the books long before.
Just long so we're before. Clear.
I got you started. You're fine without me.
See these marks right here on my shoulders?
Oh, from carrying
the fire.
Correct.
I understand. Well, by the way, it was traumatic for us too, coincidentally.
I know. I'm apologizing. Listen, there was a mix up with.
Smile never left my face when I heard the
by
news.
The way,
and Joe was flipping chairs.
Well, and you guys were fantastic. Mike, you were great. You
I
were
was
very awesome.
So apologize.
It was not a problem.
Hold on. You weren't really apologetic. You just shoved Mike Geyer right under the table. You said, "Listen,
I left town. I split.
It just took
didn't
off.
Know where I was, right?
It was like the Road Runner. You see that smoke
out of here.
Feet.
But you know what? It does seem when you it lends to the question when you are looking for a witness. Okay, how does that typically work when it comes to you guys?
Well, we vet them and spend a lot of time looking at their resumes and doing Zooms and meeting them if we have to, because you're tied in. You know, it's, we do things, as you know, on a contingent fee. We don't get our client money, and we don't get paid unless we win the case. And the only way you can win those kinds of cases is with really good expert witnesses.
And when you're doing, and you're putting the money out for that witness.
Yeah, the money, the time, their overnight, you know, the hotel room and all that. So
I guess being a great witness also is knowing, you know, like, in other words, what not to say if it's wrong. You know what I mean?
Well, the witness we had at the trial, the arbitration last week with that toxic lung drug, we had a cardiologist. The guy was awesome.
The Cleveland Clinic. He was just
so, like, easy. He took a complicated, you know, electrical physiology readings of the heart and just made it so easy to understand.
Well, I always wanted to know that, like, if, since I would imagine that I'm an, it's in a sense why I can do these shows, because I'm a listener. If I, when I
are you a listener? I know, I think you're a talker.
It's kidding. But what I'm saying,
I was gonna like her.
What I'm saying is that if I'm building a website, right, and there's a complicated process, I don't call my smart friends up, you know, the ones that know everything there is to know about everything, because I know they're going to figure it out. I call my buddies that are like me, that are like regular guys that are going to look at it. So the jurors are regular people, and if it's a real complicated topic, okay, how do you deal with that? In other words, I guess what you just said, that doctor was phenomenal. He took a very, you know, not complicated or, you know, sophisticated situation and made everybody listen.
That's a great question, because we had an arbitration.
Hold on for one second. You hear that? That was a great question.
Yeah, because you said it. You weren't listening.
We had an arbitration, and they had a very professorial doctor.
Hold on for one second. Can you get the thesaurus out there? What
they didn't do is they just asked the doctor a question, and he talked for about 15 minutes, would you say? 10 minutes?
Like he was given a lecture in medical school.
And
like,
so what the lawyer has boring. To do is break it down. Hey, doctor, you just said that's an ablation, which is this. What does that mean? And you have to break it down, like, because I know what that word means, because I've been living the case for 4 years. But the judge might not know. The jury might not know. And every time there's a word, and I have to break it down, and that's what the lawyer's there for, to break it down. Hey, you just said this. Could you explain that? Right. Hey, and even though, because the doctor is used to lecturing med students, not jurors.
Right.
I used to say I have to be able to explain it to my dad,
right?
For me to be able to understand it. And some people have it, and some people don't. And the medical school professor, you know, bow tie, the whole works. And he would just start talking without the lawyer prompting him. But you have to say, you know, oh, then what happens next? Mm-hmm. Well, what if that happens? Why is that important? And some experts are really good at it, and they kind of know how to use simple words, and then others want to be the smartest person in the room, and that never works ever.
And I guess as an attorney, you have to manage that, really, like, kind of micromanage whenever you see somebody going off the rails. Because if you don't have an idea of what they may know, if you're too smart for your own good, and you're thinking, okay, you're not realizing that there's 12 people over there or whatever.
It's a perfect example. You're not listening to the answer. Like, you're not listening to the answer. And that's the problem, because you're not because then the judges or the jury's not listening, because then those words are hard, especially in a medical malpractice case. Those words are hard. Those concepts are very difficult. It took me 3 or 4 years with my expert to understand it. They're not going to be able to understand it in an hour with your testimony unless I break it down appropriately.
Many times, and I have no problem doing this, saying, I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't asking the right kind of question. Let me rephrase it. My bad. Maybe I'm not being clear.
How often, by the way, does that happen with a medical professional, where you have to kind of back up and say, listen, you know, let's make sure that the jury understands here, because you're going, you know, textbook on me.
You can't say that during their testimony.
I get
but
it.
It's like the last thing you say before you pat them on the butt and go, all right, let's go.
Yeah.
Make it simple.
Have you had, you're very experienced. Have you had a numbers of situations where you get in there and say, okay, let's back up a little bit.
Yeah, we totally say, you're using a word that these people aren't going to understand. You got it. I've said that. I go, you're using words that we're just not going to get. You got to break this down for us.
One of our older cases from 20 years ago, we still joke about it. We had this anesthesiologist from Phoenix, and we were talking about some kind of anesthesia drug or something, and he said, well, that wasn't contraindicated. And they're like, all right, was not, that's a negative. Contra, that's
a negative.
So does that mean it was indicated? And we still joke about, like,
I'm like, you can't talk like that.
It wasn't contraindicated. And I'm like, oh, man.
I remember that day, Michael. You called me and said, what does contraindicated mean? And I said, well, I'm in the middle of I'm at the nightclub right now. In the middle of a security meeting.
It was not contraindicated.
Yeah, no, I mean, when any idea of when the trial is going to be rescheduled?
No, we had to file a motion to get the judge to get it rescheduled. We're waiting for him to set us up with a hearing, and it'll be... maybe, hopefully, 2024. Could be 2024.
Wow, and that's a tough one. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll have more from the Schaefer and Geyer Show in just a minute.
We are there in your community. Small business owners, mechanics, police officers, homemakers. And we are there serving our nation in the Air Force Reserve. When medical emergencies arise, we meet the challenge. In cybersecurity, protecting and defending in cyberspace. When natural disasters happen, we are there in space. As a strong part of the nation's defense, we are there in the community, and we are there for our nation. We share a vision to make a difference, united and focused, taking pride in being there in service of our country. We are Reserve Citizen Airmen, and we are there with over 180 different jobs to serve your country. Air Force Reserve. Go to afreserve.com for more information.
My daughter Brinley is here at St. Jude. Coming here was literally life or death, and it was so scary. But St. Jude is fighting for one goal, like this one mission, life. And that gave us hope. We haven't received a single bill from St. Jude, so I really can just focus on what's best for Brinley.
Finding cures, saving children. Learn more at stjude.org.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Schaefer and Geyer Show here on WWDB. We've got a fantastic show. Caitlin Files is in the house.
Hi, Joe.
Hello, Caitlin. And we had an awesome on the docket segment, talked a lot of sports. Let's talk Files Law.
Okay.
If you would, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and the firm.
Sure. So I'm from Bucks County. I practice at a big work comp law firm while in law school and then for about 10 years following there. And then I opened up my own workers comp practice out in Bucks County, Levittown, Pennsylvania, Joe's favorite place in the world.
Woo!
And I've been open for 4 years running workers comp cases out there.
Fantastic. And having said that, we talk about work comp. You know, we were talking about the way, obviously personal injury cases go and the fact that, especially when you're talking about it, personal education and all the experts, do you have experts? Do you ever have experts in work comp?
We do. We do have experts. We see a lot of the same experts over and over again. It was actually so interesting listening to you guys talk about your trials, because work comp is literally nothing like that. Even if it's from the same injury, our litigation path is going to look so different.
And what type? Oh, so you typically handle, you have the doctors on that usually treat the patients?
Yeah, so our experts, we just see a lot of the same doctors over and over in workers' compensation. So we use a lot of the same doctors, and the defense uses all the same doctors for their IMEs and workers' comp.
So there are a number of cases where personal injury and work comp overlap.
Absolutely, for sure.
Okay, and they're called third-party cases?
Yep. We call them third-party yep. cases.
I know you three didn't know that, so I'm letting this know. Yeah. Let's talk, and by the way, you know, the firm, when I say Schaefer, the firm Schaefer and Geyer, you know, you handle a lot of med mal, but you handle a wide array.
We do construction cases. We do premises liability cases. We do auto cases. We do sexual abuse cases. Kaylin, do you specialize in any particular comp type of comp cases? I know some people do healthcare work, construction work, or is it
all of it?
All your general services?
All of it, yeah. So we do all comp. And then we do dabble in Social Security disability, but it has to be a good case.
So tell our listeners what the difference between Social Security is.
The difference between disability and retirement?
No, disability in a workers' comp case.
Oh. So Social Security disability is the government-run program. So work comp, you have to be hurt on the job, and you don't have to have paid into the system. It really doesn't matter. You can get paid under the table, and you can still qualify for workers' comp. Social Security disability, there are two different programs.
We don't advise it, but go ahead.
I'm just saying. Yeah, right. Social Security disability, you have to pay to play. You right. have to have paid into your taxes, and then it's essentially disability insurance that you can apply for if you are sick, injured on the job, you just can't work anymore.
Gotcha. Yeah. Is it as difficult to get those benefits as it always has been?
It is horrible. So it takes about 2, maybe 3 years to get benefits once you apply. Once you hit the age 50, it's like the golden number. It's much easier to get it. Gotcha. Anything under the age of 50, we actually typically farm out because is it is not going to get
Yeah, right. Granted. At 50 is like the threshold.
50
where...
and then 55 is golden. Oh. But yeah, 50, 50, whenever you're
so
ready.
Line me up.
Exactly. Who's rushing?
So do you practice all throughout the
yes.
five county and beyond?
All Pennsylvania. We don't touch Jersey, but we do the whole state of Pennsylvania, especially now that it's virtual. Comp never stopped. So when COVID happened, they just transitioned virtual immediately. The courts never shut down. So now they have stayed virtual. So I can handle Pittsburgh, Scranton, Bucks County, Philly all in one day.
Oh, wow.
Boom, boom, boom.
So we talked earlier about being in Delaware County for a trial.
Right.
And yes. my question is, do you have judges or courts that you prefer to be in?
Yes. I don't love Delco. Okay. Delco is a tough one. You said tough county, I actually laugh because it's a tough comp county as well. Bucks, I like the Bucks County, particularly lower Bucks where I'm at. The Bristol courtroom is a good courtroom. Philadelphia is a great county to be in as well. Pittsburgh's decent. Middle of the state's kind of tough.
So it's the same as
it's
the
typical.
Yeah. Common police court?
Yes.
I was with a workers' comp judge recently, and they said they're having some claimants come in live as
yes.
opposed to virtual. Is that still the case?
So the judges get to decide. And then if you want live, you can object to the virtual hearing.
Okay.
So some judges are making you come in live. Others refuse to hear you live. It depends on which judge you get. It's not by county. It's by judge.
Now, do you have a preference?
It depends on my client. Yeah. So if it's one of them that I'm like, I'm actually don't want them live, we'll go virtual.
Right, right,
but
right.
some of them, I'm like, I want to put this person in front of the judge. Yeah. So, a lot of judges want live testimony. They do want the claimant to come in, but then anything else, doctors, fact witnesses, they say just do it virtually.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. I guess they could do more.
It's so much more. Now the defense side doesn't love it because they can't bill. We used to sit in the courtroom just waiting sure. for testimony for hours. So claimant side, we couldn't do anything. We just sat there twiddling our thumbs,
right.
but the defense was just billing all that time. So the defense definitely took a hit since then.
You see the same defense lawyers all the time?
All the time. It's the comp is a very small world. You just know everyone. You know the judges. You know the attorneys. You know the doctors. I mean, I can just name so many IME doctors right now who they've never seen my face, but they know my voice because I've been asking them questions for 10 years.
And do you know, like, when you get this particular
I know exactly what
defense lawyer, it's going to be a tough one.
The whole thing. Yes. I know which cases are going to settle, which ones are not. And I'm like, oh, great. Here comes this attorney. Here comes this doc. I know what the report's going to say. So it gets very monotonous. The biggest ones that are, it's your client. It's really the injured worker who is always going to be what's coming through the door because you know which doctors are coming up and whatnot.
Right.
What are some of the most common injuries and what are some of the most catastrophic injuries you've come across?
So we get a lot of nurses' shoulders. I mean, I constantly hear, I was picking a patient up and then the patient did something funky. And when you're talking about the brachial plexus, I was like, oh my gosh, we see so much of that. Mm-hmm. Catastrophic are roofers.
Yeah.
So my worst case that I remember, it was a roofer. He didn't actually fall off the roof, but it was so hot up there and the chemicals that he was using, he actually developed brain damage. He doesn't remember like 6 days of his life. Oof. Coming down off the roof, being so dehydrated, and the chemicals that he was just breathing in this, I guess up on the roof, it was like 120 degrees up there. It was something crazy. Wow. And that was a pretty rough one. So it wasn't actually even the falling off of the roof. It's just the conditions of being up on the roof that you see a lot of terrible injuries.
We've done some construction cases, and we talk about this fall protection. And so it's when these guys, or women, mostly guys, but they have these ropes, they're called lanyards, and they're supposed to tie off if they're over 10 feet. And it's like, I'm scared of heights. I could tell you, I would be using it. They never use them.
No, I've never seen
like,
yeah.
They're like cats okay. up there. They are like cats up there.
So never
they
seen are, a river with a lanyard.
There, right?
Let me jump in right there. Right? You know what I did before?
I know.
I was an iron worker. Yeah. And my dad ran the union for 40 years. And we never had, ever had, like when we were walking, there was no static lines or anything like that back in 82, 83, 84. Yeah. I remember walking across a beam. Right on JFK here, 18th and JFK, a diagonal. And, you know, I wanted to practice because, you know, it's funny, but when you're doing it, right, everybody else is doing it, so you're going to do it, right? I don't know how, you know, I mean, you're 18 years old. But anyway, I remember, you know, the journeyman yelling at me and stuff like that. And I you know, you get used to the heights, but at the same time, you know, there were instances I could go and tell. This is not my show. This is your show, so I'm not going to.
Don't believe it.
But you know, after working a beer, you know. It's
well, on that point, iron workers are a tough breed, and I can remember when they were building Liberty Comcast 1 and Comcast 2.
Right, my cousin Raymond did that. Right.
There were two or three bars around here, and at lunchtime, you'd see the iron workers having a beer or two, mm-hmm. and. You know, you knew they were going
hold
back
on.
Up.
Going back
it's
up.
Why it's why lunch is 30 minutes and not 60. That happened, by the way, that happened before I got in.
I don't think there were any major falls, no. injuries, or deaths out of these two towers.
And no.
They're huge.
Right.
But maybe they just needed the little bit of alcohol to
steady
them.
Get back up there.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely a lifestyle. And you know, I always used to joke around and say that nepotism will get you on the 50th floor of the Bell Atlantic Tower. You know, yeah. I mean, in my trade and all my cousin Raymond actually connected Comcast 1 and he was the foreman on, and he worked with the crane. So the guy's mm-hmm. putting up the beams and stuff like that. And so, yeah, we, you know, it's, but when you talk about the injuries and stuff like that, catastrophic comes to mind because not a lot of iron workers are getting, well, you get a lot of pullbacks and stuff like that. And you know, I was wondering, and I was going to ask Kate when you were talking, I did think about this being injured and, you know, coming from the world I lived in, and I on a daily basis, when somebody gets injured and they go in front of a judge, okay, and the judge denies them. Mm-hmm. Does that do something to their psyche, especially when they're busted up?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even just getting the initial denial from the insurance company, those initial phone calls that go on for the first 3 weeks, every single day of calling in, I just don't understand how I was denied. I just don't understand how I denied. I'm not lying. And it's trying to explain to them the insurance company doesn't care. They don't care who you are. You just, your name came across, they saw an injury, they decide to deny it, and they don't really have to answer for themselves unless you bring a lawsuit. So it's really messy there. And then if the judge denies, that's rough. Because that's it. That's really the end of the road. Unless you have a real appealable issue, which is tough, that's it. There's nothing else after that. So it's really hard to have that conversation.
In both cases, you know, you talk about what happened, Michael Geyer, and that case where the, you know, the expert went off the rails. Okay. And in your world, Caitlin, you know, when they get a denial, do you feel, how do you counsel the individual at that point? You feel more, you know, like a personal counselor than you do a legal counselor when you have to explain that now you got to go back to, and it doesn't have to be that particular situation, but when, you know, it could be, you know, the process, just the process of a 2 to 3 year situation where, you know, the insurance company's messing with the person, and in your same world, in your world, how do you handle that with the client?
Well, our client was in the courtroom the entire time. We adore the family, and they know we're on their side. We know, they know we have their back, and it was not an issue from the beginning. I mean, they know we're fighting for them. They saw us there for 9 or 10 days and spending the month of December preparing. So it was never a question that we're not doing the right thing for them.
No, I know that. I'm just saying that once something goes bad, or even during the process, when the insurance companies, you know, stalling, you know, do you find yourself having to kind of like, you know, you just kind of work with the client, counsel them, you know?
Like, I think that that's important. Like, when it's setting expectations in the beginning, the first meeting.
Yeah.
And it's because people are like, some people think this is going to take 30 days. And I'm like, no, this is going to take two and a half years. And so they're like, what? Maybe 3 years. And so when you have that expectation, then they just have a better sense of, because it's our reality. So we don't know what their reality is. Their reality might be from television, might be something they read her from a friend. Our reality is our reality because we've been doing it for 33 years plus. And that's our reality because we know it. And I'm sure, Caitlin, yours is the same. How do you deal with your clients when you have to explain to them, quote unquote, reality, medical bills and stuff like that?
Right. Same thing. I mean, you said legal or personal counselor. It's kind of the same thing balled into one. Some days I'm explaining a legal term, other days I'm explaining the process. I mean, from the beginning, you have to say, this could take this long. So security disability, I always say, this could take 3 years. You're not going to get a decision in 3 months. We will still be having conversations 3 years from now if you're going to sign up for this. So it's setting expectations in the beginning, for sure, telling them everything that they can expect to come. But then as Michael, I was about to just call you Geyer, so everyone knows who I'm talking about.
Everybody else does.
No problem.
As Geyer said, it's, they see you fighting for them. I lost a case and my client was upset, but he was also like, I know you did your best, so it is what it is. And I was like,
when you're working together, when it's a third party case, okay, let's talk about that dynamic. Somebody gets injured, okay, it's some, you know, it's another negligent party, you know, get injured on the job, okay, what's the process on and that dynamic and the importance of communication between the two firms?
Yeah, so, I mean, typically the comp case moves faster than the third-party case. We're about a year. The work comp judges have to get their cases off the docket within the year. So typically the case actually normally comes through the third-party attorneys, and then it gets sent to the comp attorney. We handle the work comp side of things, but our case is moving. We get them out to the doctor, and we just stay in contact and let the third-party attorneys know, this is what's going on. We're going to send here. Do you have a problem with them? Do you want us to send somewhere else? Would you rather send to this place? We always just stay in communication about what's going on.
The way it works at the end game is, let's say the comp case results in a payment of $50,000 in medical expenses and $75,000 in loss of income. That $125,000 total, we call that a lien. We get the paperwork from Caitlin. We use that lien in our case to establish hard losses, hard dollar figures. But by that point, the workers' comp case is largely concluded, and we take the finished product and use it in our case.
And certainly when you talk about the medical and that, you know, the coordination of everything, how important does that impact both sides?
It's huge. So We have doctors that we use and we trust. Like Geyer said, we vet. Like, I don't want to send to a doctor that I don't know if they're my client's going to be good hands. But if the third party attorney ever says, you know, I don't like that doctor, I'd rather send here, I'm usually fine with that. I don't have a problem. But you have to control the medical.
What about compliance on both sides? You know, you've been doing this a long time. How important is it to stay on top of that as attorneys?
What we try to tell our clients is, when it comes to treatment, is if your doctor is telling you that you have to go to the doctor for treatment, you should be going because you want to get better. You know, if the doctor says you need physical therapy to get better, by all means, go get physical therapy because you're going to get better. But 2 years from now, when you're getting cross-examined and there's a letter that says you need physical therapy and you didn't go, you're going to look bad when you didn't go have any documented care, and you're going to say, I was too busy. It didn't hurt that bad. Well, we're going to have to answer those questions, because you didn't listen to your doctor. And like, because we're not going to be able to say it really, really hurt bad, but I didn't go to the doctor. That's not the answer. So let's be proactive with your health, because you want to get better. We want you to get better. We might be lawyers, but we're human beings. We want you to get healthy. We want you to get better.
What about communication between the firms? One of the issues that, and I know we've, you know, done take a rocket science to you know, the number one complaint about lawyers is communications and stuff like that. Right now, good firms like you guys are you know, you put a premium on it, right? I assume you have the same expectations when you're working with other lawyers. You know, in other words, not, you know, it's a third party case. Schaefer and Geyer and Fires Law have to communicate just like the Files Law and Schaefer and Geyer and your clients.
Typically, we'll reach out to the workers' comp attorney and say, where are we on medical treatment? Because they're more hands-on the first 6 months or year than we are. So where are we? And too many cooks spoil the broth. You don't really need our opinion to say, hey, I think they need a cervical MRI. Mm-hmm. You can handle that. But the communication is in the form of, where are they on medical care? And we haven't really talked about what a workers' comp attorney does regarding investigation. Let's say there's multiple contractors and you got a guy up in a cherry picker. And,
just thinking the same thing.
Yeah. That's done coordinated.
That's what I wanted to know. What about investigating the cases? For the facts and all the details.
So it really just depends on the case. There's a lot of things that come into the third party case that never comes into comp. Like negligent, it doesn't matter for comp. It's a no fault system. So let's say that there was OSHA violation, something like that. It doesn't matter in comp, whereas they might actually really want to know that, or the police report. We're only looking at it to see if there's an injury listed, but I don't actually care what happened.
Because it
doesn't matter.
Right. So
it just happens if there's an injury. So a lot of the investigation I get from the third party attorney, or the defense attorney sends me the personnel file, and then I pass that on to the third party attorney.
Well, what I was going to say is, when you get a case and say you get it first, you're checking to see if there's a third party element so you can send it out, right?
Oh, yeah. That's what you're looking for in every single first client meeting is, do I have any more cases here that I can then send on out?
Can you get your fee is, I know it's different than ours.
Mm-hmm.
When can you start receiving a fee, and who can you get it from?
So ours is 20%. And then we can only get it essentially on wages. Now there's a new law that came down that sometimes you can collect on medical. But now it's turned into, well, then who eats that 20%? Is it the doctor eats the 20%? Or does the doctor then get to bill the injured worker for that 20% that your attorney is now collecting? So my firm doesn't take 20% on the medical out of respect for the injured worker and the doctor. But it's typically you get paid by the insurance carrier out of the 20% loss wages. And you can start collecting as soon as you do something. So let's say that my injured worker is already collecting when they come to me, but they have an opinion of full recovery and they are now litigating to kick them off benefits. If we go to that first hearing and I defeat this supersedious petition, then I get to start collecting 20%.
What just so the listener understands, the contingency fee agreement, there's no out-of-pocket cost for retaining either of you at this table, correct?
Correct.
And so when you talk about your fee, you're talking about fee only if you win the case,
only
right?
Only if we win.
Okay.
There's no fee if we lose your case. You don't have to pay us.
And the same.
Of course, yeah. Right. And most importantly, all the expert costs that we get, we front.
Right.
We're responsible for those.
And that's, and that literally, if this, when you talk about the 3 years and the 2 years and stuff like that, you run a contingency.
Litigation costs in the third-party cases are huge, I'm assuming, compared to comp, too. Cause
we don't have a case that's under six figures for expenses.
Yeah, they're wild.
That's just incredible. And none of that comes out of it is not out of the pocket of the injured.
Yeah, not while the litigation's going.
Exactly. All right, so listen, this was an incredibly fast broadcast. Caitlin Files.
It was fun.
It was fun.
I know. Second time's a charm.
Contact.
I apologize on the record.
I'm still
on the record.
We owe you a third time.
Contact information for
Sure. The website is filesinjurylawyers.com. Instagram, Files Law Office. Same with Facebook. Phone number 215-987-6452.
Michael Schaefer.
Schaefer and Geyer. SchaeferGeyer.com. The phone number is 215-751-0100.
And Michael Geyer, a parting words, my friend? Another good one in the books?
Another good one in the books. Just cruising into springtime. Next time we see you, Joe, it'll be mid-March, right?
That's right.
Late March, maybe. So
it will be.
It goes flying by.
It does. My God. Before I know it, I'm going to be 40 years old. I can't
know. You're aging so quickly.
I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Schaefer and Geyer Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We want to thank Caitlin Files for being our guest. On behalf of everyone on the panel, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.